It's my pleasure to be the moderator of this session together with my friend José María Gatell, who will present the three first speakers. José?
Thank you, Pedro. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. I think we have a very interesting session ahead. Again, let me remind us in the previous session that the presentations is 10 minutes, and then this would allow us for questions, at least for 3, 4, 5 questions, depending on the schedule. And so without any further delay, let's just move very quickly to the first presentation. The first abstract for this session is the title is High Prevalence of Acute HIV Infection in Sub-Saharan Africa, a Cross-Sectional Multicenter Screening Study. And the main author, the one who is going to do the presentation, is Dr. Martinson.
Good afternoon. This afternoon, I want to share with you part of our work which we've been doing mainly in sub-Saharan Africa on acute HIV infection. I'll be talking on behalf of the HIV Clinical Core Group, which is mainly based in South Africa, Malawi, and in North Carolina. Before I talk about the data, I want to give a little bit of background to acute HIV infection. This is the period following HIV acquisition when standard HIV antibody screening tests are negative. Because HIV specific immune responses, including antibodies, have yet to be developed, viral replication continues unimpeded, resulting in very high viremia. And during this window period, HIV infection can be detected only by nucleic acid testing. HIV, our acute HIV is difficult to detect as symptoms are protein. Prior studies in Malawi STD clinic report more than 1% of antibody negative clients who had unrecognized acute HIV infection. The laboratory methods to detect acute HIV are costly and not widely available, but have proved feasible in the African setting. About 5 years ago, the NIH established the Center for HIV/AIDS Vaccine Immunology, and it was created to advance the progress in HIV vaccine research. The flagship of this network is the CHAVI-001 study. The objectives of the study, the CHAVI-001 study, is mainly to recruit acute HIV subjects, their sexual partners, and HIV negative control subjects. And it's also to collect clinical specimens from the acute HIV subjects and sexual partners to study the following: the transmitted virus, the early cellular immune and antibody responses, mucosa responses, and genetics of resistance and progression. It's also to collect demographic data, current health status of the subjects, and also sexual behavior data. For the flagship study, which is the CHAVI-001, clients with negative or discordant rapid HIV tests who provided informed consent have a blood specimen pooled for nucleic acid testing. For this study, the acute HIV is defined as negative, indeterminate, or discordant antibody test with detectable RNA within 45 days of the screening. Specimens were collected at various time points for study of cellular antibody and mucosa responses during the acute HIV infection period. For this presentation, we sought to determine the acute HIV prevalence at screening and to characterize the cohort under study. So far, over 10,000 clients have been screened and 140 individuals have been diagnosed with acute HIV infection with an overall prevalence of 1.1%. Out of the 114, 90 of them have agreed to be enrolled into the cohort. Also enrolled into the cohort are 19 sexual partners of these acutes, with two of the sexual partners subsequently being diagnosed with acute HIV and have so far been moved into the study arm. Over the 48-week period, very few of these subjects have experienced any clinical events. This table elaborates further on the acute HIV prevalence. You will notice from this table that the prevalence over the five sites involved in this study, which is two from Durban, two from South Africa, and two from Malawi, STI clinics, and also one from a research center in South Africa. The prevalence across all these sites is in the neighborhood of 1%. Also, the proportion of people enrolling into the cohort is quite uniform across the five sites. The study has not been very efficient in trying to get sex partners of these acutes to enroll into the cohort. So far, only 19 have been able to get into the cohort. Of those in the cohort, the mean age is 24 years. There's equal distribution of gender between males and females, and 53% of the population of the acutes had a sexual transmitted infection at entry into the cohort. Of these, STIs, GUD or genital ulcer disease formed about 65%. The median CD4 count for the cohort is 452, and then the median HIV RNA is about 78,000 copies. For enrollment into the study, we had people who were concomitant negative or who had concomitant negative rapid tests and those who had discordant tests. Out of the 90 acutes, 66 of them had concomitant negative rapid tests. For this group, the median number of days from screening to positive Western blot was 24, and then the median HIV RNA at enrollment was just over 100,000 copies. For the discordant group, there were 23 of them. The median number of days from screening to positive Western blot was 25, almost the same as the group with the concomitant negative rapid tests. The median RNA at enrollment was, however, about 30,000 copies, which was about a third of that for the concomitant negative group. Looking at the Western blot results, the study has evolved over a period of time, so we do not have all the results for the Western blot for the 90 acutes. However, there are results for about 54 of them. At enrollment, the 7 of them were negative, 18, which is about 33%, were indeterminate, with 54% of them being positive. Looking at the longitudinal CD4 count and viral load over 3 time points for this cohort, we'll notice that the proportion of the cohort with CD4 count less than 350 cells is the same, about the same, in the range of 30 to 40% over these 3 time periods, with the at enrollment, week 24, and week 48. The proportion that had the CD4 count less than 200 cells was also about the same across the 3 time points, in the neighborhood of 6 to 8%. However, the viral load for the cohorts over the 3 time points decreased from 78,000 copies to about 20,000 copies at week 48. So in conclusion, this study demonstrates that it's possible to find high prevalence of unrecognized antibody negative acute HIV infections in STD clients across sub-Saharan Africa, which normally will be missed by the standard antibody screening test. And that 26% of the acute HIV subjects had discordant rapid HIV tests at screening. Also, 2/3 of these acute HIV patients had a genital ulcer disease, and we think that persons attending STI clinics with GUD need to be targeted for screening. I'd like to acknowledge all the patients, all the participants who in the study who from the 3 sites that I've mentioned, sponsors in NIH, and our collaborators from North Carolina, Malawi, and the Republic of South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we are a little bit behind the schedule, but we have at least time for 1 or 2 quick questions, if any. Is there any question from the floor? Just let me ask you, Dr. Martinson, a question. I mean, realizing how important it is to detect acute HIV infection in terms of public health, because many transmissions are located around these patients with a known acute HIV infection, I mean, do you recommend in those settings like the one you are working with high prevalence of HIV infection to do a viral load test, or at least a pool viral load test in all patients with negative HIV serology? Or at least in special settings like STD clinics? Or...
Yeah, we are aware that viral load testing is quite expensive. It's not available at every station in places in sub-Saharan Africa. But there are techniques which can make viral load less expensive, like pooling of samples that are coming out from negative clients. And that makes it a little bit more cost-effective in our environment.
Okay, thank you. Is there any question? If not, yes, please. Just a quick question and a quick answer.
You're recommending screening in people with genital ulcer disease. What was the actual percentage of your patients who had genital ulcer disease who turned out to have acute HIV infection?
Okay, that was about 2%. I can't remember the data right. So just slightly higher than the general population.
Thank you.
Okay, we had to move to the second presentation. The second presentation is IDX-899, a novel HIV non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor with high barrier to resistance, provides suppression of HIV viral load in treatment-naive HIV-infected subjects, and the presenting author is Carlos Sala from Buenos Aires. Carlos?
Thank you, Dr. Gatell. I want to start by thanking the organizing committee for selecting this paper for presentation. On behalf of the my collaborators and colleagues, I will present a result from a proof-of-concept study on IDX-899, a novel second-generation HIV-1 NNRT inhibitor with a high genetic barrier to resistance. IDX-899 is a potent and selective inhibitor of wild-type and NNRTI-resistant HIV. Extensive preclinical study has shown that IDX-899 has a high genetic barrier to resistance. Plasma half-life of approximately 10 hours and pharmacokinetic data supports once-a-day dosing. Single-dose studies up to 1,200 milligrams and multiple-dose studies up to 800 milligrams for 7 days in healthy volunteers have shown that IDX-899 is safe and well-tolerated. To illustrate the antiviral activity of IDX-899 against NNRTI-resistant HIV-1 clinical isolates, this graphic shows full change in the IC50 of a number of NNRTIs, including efavirenz here at the back, the Ardea compound, the 2-TMC, cannot see very well from here, TMC-125, TMC-278, against a panel of NNR-resistant clinical isolates. And what you see is that IDX-899 retains antiviral activity against all the efavirenz-resistant viruses, here at the back in red, and has a comparable antiviral activity to the both TMC compounds, again, all these isolates with a single, double, or triple mutants, including 103N, 181, among others. So the MV05A002 study is a proof-of-concept study that was designed to assess safety, antiretroviral activity, and pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic relationship of IDX-899. The study was conducted at a single center in the city of Buenos Aires. It was a sequential cohort, double-blind, placebo-controlled study in treatment-naive infected HIV-1 infected individuals. Eligible subjects was randomized in a 1-to-2 ratio to receive active IDX-899 or a placebo within one of three sequential cohorts at the following doses: 800 milligrams, 400 milligrams, and 200 milligrams once daily, and the treatment period lasts 7 days. At the end of the treatment period, those subjects who were not eligible to initiate highly active antiretroviral therapy were placed on Calitra monotherapy for 28 days avoid the risk of selecting NNRTI-resistant mutants after discontinuation of IDX. Main eligibility criteria shown on this slide, HIV-infected adults had a plasma HIV RNA equal or greater to 5,000 copies per ml. CD4 T-cell count was about 200 cells. They were antiretroviral therapy naive and free of eye-defining illnesses or chronic hepatitis for Hep C or Hep B. They had to have no pre-existing NNRTI drug resistance based on genotyping at screening. Based on characteristics of the study group are on this slide, divided by dosing cohorts and the placebo group. Given the small number of subjects, we can say that the characteristics were generally comparable. The HIV RNA at baseline was between 4.36 to 5.09. CD40 cells were in the range of 400 cells for the dosing cohorts, 600 cells for the placebo group. And of note, almost half of the patients who participated in this trial have the subtype, the recombinant BF. And this is consistent with prior data already published from the City of Buenos Aires about the circulating HIV subtypes in the Buenos Aires area. Okay. For the efficacy analysis, changing HIV in plasma HIV RNA from baseline to day 8 was evaluated for two different assays. Initially, the results were evaluated by the Roche TACMAN assay. Subsequently, the analysis was repeated with the AmpliCore assay. Using the Roche TACMAN assay, the Delta viral load at day 8 was 178 for the 800 milligram cohort, 1.65 for the 400 milligram cohort, 1.61 for the 200 milligram cohort. Results by the AmpliCore assay were 178, 181, 184 for the 800, 400, and 200 milligrams cohort respectively. So during conduction of the study, it became apparent that there was a difference in the results obtained by the TACMAN assay and by the AmpliCore assay. We further explored this difference and we confirmed data previously published by Damon et al. From France, also reported by Julio Montaner in Vancouver, among others, about the discrepancy in the results. This graphic shows Bland and Altman curve, which is methods frequently used to assess agreement between results obtained by two different assays. I'm not going to go into the statistics, but just in simple words, if the assays are in agreement, all the values will fall on this horizontal line, green horizontal line in here. For this study, this regression line with the results obtained in our study, what you see is goes below the reference line and to the right of the 5,000 copy threshold we used for entry criteria, indicating that the TACMAN assay was underestimating the results obtained by the AmpliCore assay. So this graphic, this slide summarized the efficacy results, and as you can see, there was a viral load decline up to approximately 1.80 logs after 7 days of therapy. And the lines are superimposed suggesting at each time point, suggesting that the antiviral activity of IDX-899 was the same for each of the cohort, each of the doses tested. So regarding the pharmacokinetic, the PK-PD, the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamic relationship, was evaluated by plotting the trough value, the C-mean at day 7 against the delta viral load at day 8. And what you see in this graphic is, first, is that each single individual had a trough that was well above the protein binding adjusted EC50. And secondly, that there was no clear relationship of the trough with the antiviral efficacy, probably due to this good concentration obtained at the C-mean. On the right-hand side panel, what you see is the mean of the concentration of the drug, the trough, for each of the for each of the cohorts. And again, what you see is that the mean was exceeding well above the protein binding adjusted EC50. So regarding CD4 changes, as you would expect, there was a positive increase in CD4 T cell counts compared with the placebo arm. And regarding adverse events, IDX-899 was very well tolerated. There were no serious adverse events, no patient discontinuating the trial. And what you can see here for the different cohorts is just the adverse event was they were mild to moderate in intensity and evenly distributed across the dosing groups and also the placebo groups. So in summary about on the safety data, no treatment emergent serious adverse events were observed or premature discontinuations. There were no patterns in adverse event between the treatment groups. There were no grade 3 or 4 laboratory abnormalities during the study treatment period. And the laboratory profile was similar between the IDX-99 groups and the placebo groups. So in conclusion, IDX-99 was generally safe and well tolerated in HIV-infected subjects. IDX-99 demonstrated potent antiviral activity with 1.8 log reduction by the Amplicor assay. There were no clear PK-PD relationship, likely due to the high trough level that was well above the IC90. We found that the Roche Tachman assay frequently underestimated viral load and viral load reduction compared with the Amplicor assay. Based on these results, the protocol was amended to add a 100 milligram cohort, which has been already initiated. Let me finish by thanking all the patients who volunteered in the study, the Argentinian physicians who collaborated with us, and particularly our team at Acleres Argentina, Claudia Choa, Jose Luis Hipólito, Gabriela Luna, and the IDENIX team, Jai Chen, Jeff Moller, Valerie Philippon for helping in the presentation, Lin Su for their continued support. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Carlos, for the nice presentation of this new promising non-nucleoside. Is there any question or comment from the audience?
Yeah, hi.
Yes, please, Joe.
Joe Iran from Chapel Hill. There didn't seem to be any dose concentration relationship across the three doses. Is that due to a difference in bioavailability or autoinduction in terms of trough concentration?
Well, the trough concentration at day 7 was quite high. Actually, it was a 5 to 50 fold above the protein binding adjusted IC50. So we think that with that kind of level, it will be difficult to differentiate a trend in concentration versus effect.
Yeah, no, I wasn't thinking of concentration and effect. Just in terms of dose and concentration, there didn't seem to be any relationship.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes. No, we haven't seen that. You saw that the mean values were quite similar for
right.
The three cohorts, but it was just 7 days. There is a little bit of accumulation, but I'm not be sure about that.
Richard?
Halbrick, San Diego. Have you looked for resistance either with standard bulk culture or with more sensitive methods such as allele-specific PCR 454 to look for minority variant emergent?
We have no data yet, clinical data yet. This is the first clinical study. All the resistant data is from the in vitro studies. We are still sequencing samples for those patients who remain detectable at the end of the study. But, some of them are already on treatment or were already on treatment.
Just let me clarify these points. For those patients at day 7 who were not undetectable, did you test for resistance? Or?
Absolutely, yes.
And does any patient select?
The analysis is ongoing. We haven't completed the analysis. Some of those patients will be undetectable if they start hard right after completing the trial.
Okay.
The study drug.
Pedro has a question. Yeah.
Carlos, very, very nice presentation. Two quick questions. First, you didn't see any CNS effect nor rashes?
No. We haven't seen rash, we haven't seen abnormal dreams, but we have to be cautious because it's just 7 days of therapy. But I also have to say that the safety profile was quite consistent what we saw in the healthy volunteers trial.
Okay. And second, you showed that some patients gained up to 60 CD4s. Was it in a 7 days period? Because this is a little striking. In other studies that we performed, we didn't see that difference in CD4s.
Yes, I knew that question was coming from you. But I say that the number of patients were very small. I see there were probably some outliers that, you know, were driving the result. Yeah, we were surprised too. But, you know, we prefer not to comment because there is a small number of patients, so we prefer to see future studies.
Okay, thank you, Carlos.
Thank you.
So I think we have to move to the next. We have to move to the next presentation. That is again another novel non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. This time is RDEA 806 in treatment of naive patients. And the presenting author is Dr. Graham Moyle. Graham.
Thanks very much, Jose, and thanks to the organisers for accepting this abstract. So I'm going to talk about RDEA 806, which is a new non-nucleoside drug, and we've done a study of similar design to the previous presentation in treatment-naive HIV-positive individuals. The study was conducted at our site in London together with a site in Vienna and a site in Hamburg in Germany with collaboration for our colleagues at RDEA Biosciences. So we already know a reasonable amount about RDR-806. It's a potent, selective agent with activity against the mutations that we typically see with efavirenz or nevirapine. It requires multiple mutations before we see substantial changes in viral sensitivity, and it has a high cytotoxicity safety index. It's highly protein-bound, and the metabolism is through a range of CYP enzymes, and it doesn't result in either inhibition or induction of those CYP enzymes, as has been confirmed by interaction studies with ritonavir, where no significant interaction was observed, and indeed no interaction described with Truvada. None of the metabolism is through 2B6, which of course is the polymorphic enzyme that affects efavirenz clearance. The animal reproduction studies have been completed, and it shows no evidence of teratogenicity or impairment of fertility. And the compound is highly water-soluble, enabling ready formulation. These are some of the resistance data that were presented at ICAC last year, looking at selection experiments using both a wild-type virus and a virus with a K103N mutation already present, comparing the emergence of resistance, first of all, with efavirenz, where, of course, we just get accumulation of an additional non-nucleoside mutation when K103 is already present, and, of course, K103 is the first emergent mutation with efavirenz, whereas with 806 we see a delayed emergence of resistance with either of these mutants and a selection of a similar pattern of mutation with the signature mutation that has appeared in a number of samples of K104E, but requiring multiple additional mutations before substantial fold shifts are observed. So orienting to you to this slide, very similar to one that Carlos showed, we're looking at a panel of single, double, and triple mutant viruses here, looking at RDR-806, entelensotravirine, TMC278, and efavirenz, showing that RDR-806 maintains susceptibility to this panel of viruses in a similar way to the two TiboTec compounds, with sustained activity against viruses showing substantial fold shifts in susceptibility to efavirenz. So just to summarise what we know about the drug from healthy volunteer studies, where over 120 individuals have been exposed in both single and multi-dose studies, up to 14 days and up to 1,000 milligrams per day. The drug has been well tolerated in those individuals with no characteristic adverse events identified, and most specifically in healthy volunteer studies, we've not seen any central nervous system side effects that would be similar to efavirenz, nor has drug-related rash been seen over that up to 14 days of dosing. There are also no significant trends observed within laboratory parameters, except for changes in uric acid levels, which relate to an HIV inactive metabolite of 806, which is subject to separate interest as development as an anti-gout compound, and that the changes in cholesterol and triglycerides in volunteers given RD806 in multi-dose studies show trends in a downward direction. The drug has good oral bioavailability, as one would expect from a water-soluble compound, linear pharmacokinetics, and a terminal half-life of between 11 and 13 hours at multiple dosing without any accumulation. The formulation going forward is an enteric-coated tablet formulation, which is used in the third and fourth of the cohorts that I'll show in a moment, and that formulation can be dosed without regards to food. As I mentioned, there is no significant interaction seen between either ritonavir or Truvada. So the study concerned, the 201 study, is proof of activity. It's conducted across three centres in a double-blind, placebo-controlled manner in treatment-naive individuals. So we have 48 individuals involved, and those are randomised in a 3-to-1 manner to RD806 or placebo. There are 7 days of dosing, followed by a morning dose on day 8 for PK, and then individuals have the option of starting antiretroviral therapy after that, the completion of that PK period. We have 4 sequential dose cohorts. 2 of them used a capsule formulation, and the second 2 at the higher doses used the enteric-coated formulation that will resemble what is going forward. The doses looked at included 400 milligrams twice a day, 600, 800 and 1,000 milligrams once a day. So in terms of the assessments, we looked at daily HIV RNA. We had PK both at baseline and at day 8, and we had follow-ups through day 10 and then subsequently at day 14, together with other standard evaluations, specifically ECGs on multiple days, genotypes and phenotypes. So the participants in the study were male patients aged between 18 and 65 years of age. They had chronic HIV infection and had never received antiretroviral therapy or had received less than 14 days of prior exposure. They were required to have HIV RNAs greater than or equal to 5,000 copies per mil, and CD4 requirements varied across the centres according to IRB requests. So in Germany and Austria, they included individuals with CD4 counts greater than 350. In the UK, we initially allowed in individuals greater than 50 and subsequently greater than 200 for the latter two cohorts. Individuals were required to be clinically well with no history of an AIDS-defining illness, and they were required to have no pre-existing mutations, either in reverse transcriptase or protease, according to the genotypes performed. In addition, no co-infection with acute hepatitis A or chronic B or C. So this table shows the baseline characteristics of individuals across the different dose cohorts. They were individuals who I would probably now consider to be young. They were predominantly Caucasian, although there were some individuals of other ethnicities, and they had CD4 counts that were typically around the 300s. The viral load copies in each group averaged between 30 and 50,000 copies. So this slide shows the outcome during the 7-day dosing period, and the collection of samples post 7 days through day 10 and subsequently 2 weeks post dosing, remembering that the data beyond this time point is censored for individuals who commenced on heart regimens subsequent to participation in the clinical study. We can see rapid declines in viral load through day 7. with little change in the placebo group. And on the next table, I will detail that. You'll notice that there is a post-dose effect, that after the completion of day 8 dosing, there is some continued decline in viral load across the groups. So summarizing the viral load changes across the different dose groups, the median values together with the interquartile ranges are shown in this table at the day 8 primary endpoint analysis, and we saw in the placebo group a change of upwards of 0.2 of a log consistent with variation in the viral load assay, and then the change by AmpliCore assay for the four different dosing groups, 1.8 log for 400 BD, 1.3 log for 600 QD, 1.8 and 1.8 for 800 and 1,000 milligrams QD. The 600 milligram dosing group did catch up somewhat at later time points in terms of the reduction in viral load, so that we had nadir time points beyond day 8, which were 0.1 or 0.2 lower than what was observed at the day 8 time point. We saw a high consistency of response, suggesting we were at the top of the dose response curve, with 100% of individuals in the 400 BD, 800 QD and 1000 QD groups experiencing a one log or more decrease in viral load. And you'll note that some people also achieved a less than 400 copy value within just 7 days of dosing. Looking at adverse events that were emergent during the course of the study, one can see that there is a limited number of adverse events, and no individuals discontinued the study due to an emergent adverse event. So we see no particular consistent pattern of adverse events associated with ARDIA 806. So no discontinuations. Adverse events were generally mild, with no interventions required and with no grade 3 or grade 4 events. We did not see reports of CNS toxicity or drug-related rash consistent with the healthy volunteer studies. The laboratory abnormalities, again consistent with healthy volunteers, showed reductions in serum uric acid levels related to this HIV inactive metabolite, which is now being developed for gout. Regarding ECG findings, we saw no QTC intervals, increases of greater than 60 milliseconds, nor values greater than 450, although this doesn't represent a major finding for QTC interval. A more definitive study will subsequently be done, but certainly there's no signal around QTC interval. And we saw no observed characteristic changes in genotype or phenotypic susceptibility at any of the time points, both on therapy and post-dose. So in conclusion, ARDIA 806 appears to be a well-tolerated non-nucleoside with robust antiretroviral activity across all of the doses tested. The antiviral activity is similar at 800 QD and 400 BD, suggesting that the drug can be dosed once a day. There are no important laboratory or ECG or clinical abnormalities observed, and a phase 2B study in treatment-naive individuals is planned across multiple once-a-day dosing. So I'd like to just thank the other participants, particularly the work of Marta Buffito and Carl Fletcher at our clinic in London, who were particularly responsible for running the PK and scheduling the patients, and the other sites in Hamburg, led by Albrecht Steuer, and in Vienna, led by Armin Reiger, and our colleagues at ARDIA and SGS Life Sciences. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Graham. I think there are some questions. Please go ahead.
Yes, this is Bernard Herschel from Geneva. How would you rate the chances of your compound that will, when matched up against TMC-278, which will actually be the competitor once this is marketed?
Well, as I showed across the chart of resistant viruses, the activity of 806 for single mutants and double mutants, particularly those that are most characteristically transmitted at the present time, shows similar activity against those mutants as TMC-278. Both drugs appear in short-term dosing to be well-tolerated, and obviously the rilpivirine data that was presented here earlier this week suggests that the drug performs similarly to efavirenz at the 25 milligram dose that they're developing going forward. So for the phase 2B at the present time, obviously rilpivirine has not reached the market. It has had some developmental delays along the way related to questions about QTC interval abnormalities, which don't appear thus far to be a problem with RDR806. So I think before we say that TMC278 is going to be the standard of care drug, we really need to wait to see the results of the phase 3 studies with that drug to see if it really stands up to the measure of those evaluations. And then I'm sure that we can evaluate RDR806 against what is the appropriate standard of care at the time.
Just another question, Graham. Maybe I miss your point, but at day 7, around 50% of the patients still had detectable viruses, okay? So had you been able to test for resistance in this about half of the patients who still remain detectable?
Yes, so we had resistance tests both at the completion of dosing, 3 days post-dosing, and 2 further weeks post-dosing. And there are no differences between placebo and the treatment groups in terms of polymorphic variation in the virus, no characteristic mutations either of IAS major mutations or of the mutations that were described in vitro that had been emergent during the course of the study.
Okay, any more questions or comments? So if not, I'll give the floor to the chair of this session, Pedro.
Thank you, Jose. Our next paper will be paper 0404, the PEARL study, ACTG A5175, a multinational study of denanosine EC, empiricitabine and atazanavir versus co-formulated cidovudine, lamivudine and efavirenz for initial treatment of HIV-1 infection, presented by Dr. Campbell.
On behalf of the AIDS Clinical Trials Group and the A5175 protocol team, I'm happy to present to you today the first findings from the PEARL study, which is a prospective evaluation of antiretrovirals in resource-limited settings. Let me first begin by giving you some background information on the origins of the PEARL study. As we've heard in other talks in this conference, data from randomized clinical trials of antiretroviral efficacy largely come from resource-rich areas of the world. ARV efficacy in resource-limited settings could be affected by multiple factors, including genetics, culture, nutrition, and environment. There's therefore a need to evaluate antiretrovirals in controlled ways in resource-limited settings. To start to address the need for these data, the ACTG formed a committee of multinational investigators in 2002 with the charge of developing a study to address what they felt would be the most pressing need for antiretroviral implementation in resource-limited setting. The committee thought that the most important question to address was the what-to-start question, what antiretroviral regimen to start in treatment-naive patients. At that time, a common antiretroviral regimen was a thymidine analog with 3TC and an NNRTI. As we saw earlier today, that's still the most common regimen used in resource-limited settings. The committee felt that data on efficacy of alternative regimens was needed, and thus the PEARLS protocol was developed and finalized in May of 2004. The primary objective of the study is to demonstrate the non-inferiority of a once-daily PI or a once-daily NNRTI-containing regimen compared to a standard regimen of twice-daily antiretroviral agents in treatment of HIV in diverse areas of the world. The study design is summarized on this slide. What I'm going to limit discussion to today is step one, which is an initial regimen. And in step one, participants were randomized in a one to three different arms, A, B, and C. A was the control arm, or the standard arm of co-formulated cidovudine lamivudine administered twice daily with efavirenz administered once daily. Arm 1B was an experimental arm of DDI-EC administered once daily, FTC once daily, and atazanavir once daily. Arm 1C, also an experimental arm, particularly for the resource-limited settings, of co-formulated tenofovir FTC once daily with efavirenz once daily. randomization was stratified by both country and screening HIV RNA, either greater than, equal to, or less than 100,000 copies per mil. The planned follow-up of duration is event-driven, and it will, the study goes until 30% of participants have met the primary endpoint. The primary endpoint for the study is treatment failure. This is the primary efficacy endpoint, and it is defined by the time from randomization to the first of the following events in an intention-to-treat analysis. First event being virological failure, which is defined as confirmed HIV RNA greater than or equal to 1,000 copies per milliliter at week 16 or later. HIV disease progression, which is defined as a new or recurrent AIDS-defining condition at least 12 weeks following study entry and not associated with IRIS, so IRIS events are excluded from the endpoint. And then lastly, death due to any cause is also part of this composite endpoint. The study population are HIV-infected men and women at least 18 years of age, naive to antiretroviral therapy, defined as no more than 7 days of previous antiretroviral therapy. However, women who took single-dose nevirapine with or without zidovudine for prevention of mother-to-child transmission were allowed to enter the study. The CD4 cell count had to be less than 300 cells per millimeter cubed in the past 90 days. 1,571 participants were recruited at 12 sites located in 8 different resource-limited countries, and that totaled 1,361 of the participants, plus 31 U.S. sites recruited 210 participants. Recruitment began in May of 2005 and was completed a year ago in August 2007. The distribution of the Pearl sites geographically is shown here. As you can see, the sites span from Hawaii to Thailand and encompass both resource-rich, medium-income countries as well as low-income countries, as well as high, medium, and low prevalence of HIV in these parts of the world. A planned DSMB review of the Pearl study occurred in May of 2008. This was the 5th regularly scheduled interim review, and this review encompassed both safety and efficacy data. The DSMB used pre-specified interim boundary with a p-value of 0.002 and corresponding 99.8% confidence intervals about the treatment arms to determine if inferiority had occurred. This DSMB review included data from all visits and specimens that had been collected through March 9, 2008. This reflected a median follow-up of 72 weeks. The loss-to-follow-up rate was quite low, 4% at 48 weeks, 6% at 96 weeks. The DSMB did not find any unexpected safety findings, and the DSMB could not reach any conclusion at this point about the comparison between arms 1A and 1C. However, the DSMB found conclusive evidence that arm 1B, the DDI-FTC-atazanavir arm, was inferior to the control arm, zidovudine-lamivudine with efavirenz, for the primary efficacy endpoint. The findings of the DSMB are summarized on this slide, providing you with the hazard ratio for the primary endpoint, as well as the 3 primary endpoint components, with brackets around it for the 99.8% confidence intervals. The dashed vertical line represents a hazard ratio of 1, so values falling to the right of the dashed line favor the control arm, zidovudine, lamivudine, and efavirenz, while values falling to the left would favor the experimental arm, DDI, FTC, and atazanavir. And as you can see, there were significant differences for the primary endpoint and the virological failure endpoint favoring the zidovudine 3TC efavirenz arm with confidence intervals that excluded one, whereas there was no significant change for the AIDS progression or death components of the primary endpoint. So what I'd now like to do is to go through some analyses that the team has performed to try to better understand these findings. Let me first show you the characteristics of our study population. In contrast to studies in resource-rich settings, almost half of our study participants were female, median age of 34. We also had a very diverse racial representation in our study. The most common racial group was self-identified black Africans, followed by Asians. Caucasians, whites, represented only 16% of our study population. Median CD4 cell count was 172. Median plasma HIV RNA at entry was 5 logs. And 18% of our study participants had a history of either prior or current tuberculosis at study entry. The characteristics of the arm 1B are provided here, and you can see that they are almost identical to the overall characteristics of the study population. This slide summarizes the primary endpoint accumulations. So this is the cumulative probability of either the primary endpoint in the dark bars or each of its components at three different study time points, 24, 48, and 96 weeks. You can see that at 96 weeks, 24% of participants in arm 1B had reached a primary endpoint, and the vast majority of those primary endpoints were due to virological failure. This slide summarizes the same data in a Kaplan-Meier plot with the primary endpoint shown in white. And you can see the important point here is that the rate of both primary endpoint and virological failure was constant throughout the study period. The different clinical events that were either death or AIDS progression are shown here. Overall, there were very few clinical events, as you might have seen from the previous slides. The most common being extrapulmonary tuberculosis, cryptococcal meningitis, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, or recurrent bacterial pneumonia. The team performed an exploratory analysis to try to see if there were any factors present at baseline that might explain these findings. So this was a multivariate analysis that initially included all of the following, all of the variables listed here. Shown on the right slide with 95% confidence intervals are the hazard ratios for things that stayed in the multivariate model. And you can see that there was a higher risk of failure for male gender, young age, and CD4 cell count, with the trend for the highest risk in the lowest CD4 strata. Also increased risk of failure for history of prior tuberculosis. And current AIDS trended towards a higher risk of failure, whereas prior AIDS at study entry trended toward a lower risk of failure. The country of origin, or the country of where the site was located, was also significant in the multivariate model. Compared to the U.S. with the referent line for a hazard ratio of 1, no country showed significantly greater risk of failure than the U.S. There were some trends towards less risk of failure, on average about the same. So conclusions, we can say that the regimen of DDI, EC, FTC, and atazanavir had a significantly greater risk of treatment failure compared to the control regimen of zidovudine, lamivudine, and efavirenz. Within the study, participants who were randomized to arm 1B are currently being switched to a study-provided NNRTI-based regimen. We can also say that the relative efficacy of this regimen varied by baseline factors, including gender, age, CD4 cell count, prior AIDS opportunistic infection, prior tuberculosis, and country. To put this in perspective, it's also important to point out that the success rates for this regimen at 48 and 96 weeks were 84% and 76% respectively. So the regimen did do fairly well. It did not do as well, however, as the efavirenz-based regimen. It's also important to point out that the finding of heterogeneity of treatment failure risk across countries should be interpreted cautiously. This analysis was not corrected for multiple comparisons. Also important to point out that caveat is that the DDI-EC dose was based on weight and was administered on an empty stomach separately from the atazanavir dose. So all components of that regimen could not be taken at the exact time, same time of day. The team is performing pharmacology, drug resistance, and adherence analysis to help explain these findings. Those results are not available at the present time. Comparisons between arms 1A and 1C are ongoing, and those continue without change. I'd also point you to several posters that are being presented here at the meeting for further information on this study. I'd like to acknowledge the many participants and sites who participated in the study, the many members of the study team. I'd also particularly like to remember Eva Smith, who died very tragically this past year.
Thank you very much. We are a little bit behind schedule. So I have only a quick question. I can't see any question from the audience. You showed that the correlates for failure for the DDI arm. Did you identify the same correlates for failure in the control arm?
We have not analyzed that in the control arm because the comparison between the control arm and the other experimental arm is still ongoing.
Okay. And could you very briefly speculate if you think that the reason for failure is attributable to the nucleoside that were selected or to the use of unboosted atazanavir?
Yeah, I couldn't guess at this point. I would say that the pharmacologic analyses that we're performing may well give us the data that's needed to answer that question.
Okay, thank you very much. So we move on to our next paper. The next paper is to be presented by Barry Bernstein. And it's a pivotal bio study comparing ritonavir 100 milligram coated tablet to ritonavir 100 milligram soft gelatin capsule in healthy adult subjects.
Thank you, Dr. Khan. And on behalf of the Abbott Pharmaceuticals Research and Development Group, I am pleased to present the results of the M10307 pivotal bioavailability study comparing Norvir tablet to a Norvir soft gelatin capsule. The objectives of our development program for the Norvir tablet are to formulate a tablet formulation which is heat stable and will result in boosting effects which are similar to that seen with the soft gelatin capsule. We initially presented data on a pilot formulation at CROI last year. This pilot formulation did demonstrate bioequivalence to the soft gelatin capsule. But unfortunately, in accelerated stability situations meant to mimic those which would be seen in developing countries or other warm or humid climates, we saw evidence of crystal formation making the formulation non-viable. We moved forward then with a reformulation, and that reformulation was placed into a pilot bioequivalent study, the M10263 study. The results of the M10263 study were presented earlier here at this conference as a poster and briefly are summarized here. The data from the study showed that the bioavailability overall was similar in terms of AUC, although the Cmax was slightly higher, about 21% higher than that observed with the soft gelatin capsule. This formulation was also placed in a variety of stability conditions. Unfortunately, as well, when left out in uncontrolled conditions at room temperature, absorbed moisture from the atmosphere and swelled up, doubling the moisture content of the tablet. As you can see here from these pictures, here is the tablet when it came out of the storage container, and here the tablet after being in room conditions for up to 2 weeks, showing the swelling of the tablet. The increased moisture content was felt as well to increase the risk of crystal formulation, and this tablet was also felt to be non-viable to move forward. I will point out that on the screen these tablets look rather large and they are not actual size. We then subsequently reformulated this tablet and moved directly into a pivotal bioequivalent study, hoping to accelerate our program and achieve our goals for submission as quickly as possible. This is the design of the M10-307 pivotal bioequivalent study. This study was designed to be a two-stage study. The first stage was a two-period crossover design intended to enroll 100 healthy volunteers. 93 were actually dosed, and evaluable PK in the first stage was available for 84 subjects. We used a confidence interval for assessment in this study of 92.8% instead of the standard 90% to accommodate the multiplicity of analyses planned with a stage two if we move forward with that part of the study. The study was designed to enroll the stage two if the lower bound of the confidence interval was below 1.118. The demographics for the population enrolled in the study are shown here. Again, this is a healthy volunteer study. Approximately half the participants were female with an average age of about 29. The plasma concentration time profile for the two formulations is shown here, and as we saw with the pilot formulation in the M10-263 study, AUC was similar between the two formulations, but Cmax, again, was slightly higher with the tablet formulation shown in blue compared to the soft gelatin formulation. Further data on the results of the study is shown here, and you can see the point estimate, which represents the ratio of the test formulation, in this case the tablet, to the reference formulation, the soft gelatin capsule. You can see approximately a 26% increase in the Cmax, similar to what we saw with the pilot formulation. With the AUC, for both the AUCT and AUC Infinity, we saw that the increases were about 10 to 13% and did meet protocol specified criteria for bioequivalence. The safety results for this healthy volunteer single dose crossover study are summarized on this slide. There were a similar number of subjects in each of the treatment groups that experienced at least one adverse event, 21% with the tablet and 24% with the soft gelatin capsule. And as you can see, the character of the adverse events was similar in the two formulations, the tablet and the soft gelatin capsule. In summary, Ben, in this pivotal bioequivalence study, we saw that AUC did meet bioequivalence between the tablet and the soft gelatin capsule. Cmax was approximately 26% higher with the tablet compared to the SGC. These results were consistent with our pilot study, and safety in a healthy volunteer single-dose crossover study were similar with the two formulations. We have assessed these results from the bioavailability of the tablet formulation vis-a-vis two criteria. The first is the expected relative safety of the tablet versus the soft gelatin capsule. And the second is an assessment of the boosting effect of the tablet versus the soft gelatin capsule. Again, in both scenarios, given the modest increase in Cmax, but similar AUC of the two formulations. First, assessing the safety of the tablet, anticipated relative to the soft gelatin capsule. We show here again the results of the pivotal study in this slide graphically demonstrating the relative bioavailability of the tablet versus the soft gelatin capsule. Here, the AUC meeting bioequivalence criteria, but with a point estimate 10 to 13% higher than the SGC, and here the Cmax approximately 26% higher than with the SGC. For the purposes of safety analysis, we turn to data from the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet. where when we look at the ritonavir component, we again see that the ritonavir exposures with the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet are higher than seen with the lopinavir-ritonavir soft gelatin capsule. In this case, about 20% higher for AUC and 35% higher for Cmax. These increases are at least as great or greater than that seen with the ritonavir tablet, and thus give us an opportunity to examine the safety of the increases in exposure by looking at the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet versus SGC. And that was performed in the M05730 study. Details of this study have been presented previously, both at this meeting and earlier this year at CROI. Briefly, this was a 664-patient study enrolling antiretroviral-naive subjects who were randomized to either a QD or BID tablet or soft gelatin formulation of lopinavir-ritonavir. All subjects also received M-tricitabine and Truvada, in the form of Truvada with tenofovir. All subjects were switched to the tablet formulation at week 8. The 8-week period of comparison was chosen because the onset of adverse events in subjects in prior trials of lopinavir-ritonavir tends to occur early, within the first 8 weeks, as do lipid elevations. So this afforded us an opportunity to examine the impact of increases in the ritonavir exposure when we looked at the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet versus the soft gelatin capsule. Here we look at the most common adverse events in this study, and they were gastrointestinal, and on this slide, adverse events of moderate or greater severity and related to study drug per the investigator. And as you can see, despite the fact that ritonavir Cmax was 35% higher with the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet versus the SGC, there was no impact on the safety profile, with nausea, diarrhea, abdominal pain, and vomiting occurring with similar frequency despite formulation and despite dosing interval. Additional analysis included lipid elevations in this study over the first 8 weeks of observation, as well as all adverse event, events of any severity or relationship to a study medication, related moderate or greater severity adverse events, discontinuations, or serious adverse events. And in none of these analyses did we see indication that the increase in ritonavir Cmax with the tablet formulation was associated with any change in the adverse event profile of the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet. Based on this data, we've concluded that the increase in Cmax of 35% with the lopinavir-ritonavir tablet and the increases with the ritonavir tablet of 26% in Cmax are not anticipated to affect the overall safety profile. And lastly, we've also examined the impact or potential impact of the increase in ritonavir exposure in the ritonavir tablet on the boosting effect for other protease inhibitors. And here you can see a variety of protease inhibitors when boosted with both 100 and 200 milligrams of ritonavir. 200 milligrams of ritonavir gives exposures which are more than twice as great as 100 milligrams of ritonavir, given the nonlinearity of the pharmacokinetics in this dose range. Therefore, the increases in ritonavir exposure are greater than 100%. Recall with the ritonavir tablet, the increases that we anticipate are only 26%. And as you can see, looking at a variety of protease inhibitors, the increase in AUC and Cmax of the boosted protease inhibitor is not substantially different when the dose of ritonavir is increased from 100 to 200 milligrams. The possible exception to this is tipranovir, but note the doses of 100 and 200 milligrams and the induction effect of tipranovir, which must be taken into consideration in interpretation of this data. Based on this analysis, we conclude that the CYP3A inhibitory effects of ritonavir are maxed at a dose of approximately 100 milligrams, and therefore the 26% increase in Cmax is not likely to further increase the exposures of the boosted protease inhibitor. So in conclusion, based on this analysis and the data from the M10307 study, We conclude that the tablet provides ritonavir exposure similar to that of the marketed soft gelatin capsule and has demonstrated stability in ongoing trials, stability trials across a broad range of conditions. The increase in ritonavir Cmax with the tablet formulation is not anticipated to impact either safety or boosting effect of this new formulation. And based on this data, we are planning on submitting the ritonavir tablet formulation for regulatory approval by the end of this year. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have time for one quick question. Based on your data,
a slide that showed the boosting effect with different protease inhibitors, you indicated a 400 milligram dose of atazanavir, whereas usually 300 milligrams would be used with ritonavir. So I was just wondering about that and why the 400 milligram dose.
These were studies which were performed by the marketing authorization holders of the respective compounds in general, and the doses were chosen by them. However, I think it's still important to note that the CYP3A inhibitory properties max out at around 100 milligrams for the ritonavir component, and therefore we don't anticipate that the modest increase in exposure with the tablet will have any impact on the boosted protease inhibitor's pharmacokinetic profile.
I think all of us probably we are very interested in knowing what is the expected timeline from now on until what's going to happen from now on if everything goes smoothly, when this tablet Abbott expects to be available, to be commercially available.
Well, we are completing work now on our food effect study with this novel tablet formulation, as well as the other stability work necessary for the submission. The stability looks very, very promising throughout a variety of temperature conditions, and we're confident that we'll be able to submit the package by the end of the year. Then it will be in the hands of regulatory agencies for their review and ultimate approval, but we hope to have approvals, at least in some countries, in 2009.
Thank you. We need to move to our last paper, High Rate of Virological Success with Dolutegravir plus Etravirine and Darunavir-Ritonavir in Treatment-Experienced Patients with Multidrug-Resistant Virus, results of the ANRS 139 TRIO trial, and this paper will be presented by Yazdan Yazdanpana.
Thank you, Dr. Khan, and good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to present this abstract on behalf of my colleagues and the ANRS. The primary objective of the TRIO trial was to assess the 24-week virologic efficacy of an antiretroviral regimen containing three new drugs, namely raltegravir, etravirine, and darunavir in HIV-infected patients failing combination antiretrotherapy with multidrug-resistant virus. Secondary objectives were to assess safety and tolerability of this combination, immunological response, virological efficacy at week 96, and drug-drug interaction. This is a phase 2 non-comparative multicenter trial. Patients enrolled in this study received raltegravir, etravirine, and darunavir, and may have also received NRTIs and or enfivirtir based on the physician's discretion. The primary endpoint of the study was the 24-week viral suppression defined as an HIV RNA less than 50 copy. Follow-up until 96 weeks of these patients is currently ongoing. Patients enrolled were patients failing combination antitherapy with HIV RNA higher than 1,000. No CD4 restriction. Patients were naive to raltegravir, etravirine, and darunavir. Patient had multidrug-resistant virus with greater than or equal to 3 major PI mutations, but were susceptible to darunavir based on the first power algorithm available at the time of design, with less than or equal to 3 mutations among the following mutations. patients had greater than or equal to 3 NRTI mutations and had a previous virologic failure on NRTIs. Both were susceptible to etravirine based on the first Tibetic analysis for etravirine with less than or equal to 3 NRTI mutation among the following. The DUET algorithm was not available at the time of design of this study. 117 patients were screened. 67 were ineligible, mostly because they did not fulfill the study genotype criteria. 103 patients were included. 2 discontinued the study treatment, 1 because he was lost to follow-up and 1 because he presented a grade 4 clinical adverse event. 101 patients completed the trial through week 24. Baseline characteristics of patients are presented on this slide. Mean age was at 45 years. Median HIV RNA was at 4 log and median CD4 at 255. Patients had received ART for a median of 13 years prior to enrollment in this study. Median number of major PI mutations was at 4, NRTI mutations at 5, and NNRTI mutations at 1. The proportion of patients with more than 3 darinavir mutations was at 35%, and with more than 3 etravirine mutations at 3%. 14% of patients did not receive any optimized background therapy with the ratlegavir, etravirine, and darinavir combinations. 83% received NRTIs and 12% enfibrotid. 10 out of 12 of those who received enfibrotid were enfibrotid naive. The genotypic sensitivity score of the optimized background therapy based on the INRS algorithm was 0 in 20%, 0.5 in 39%, 1 in 24%, and more than 1 in 17%. This figure shows the proportion of patients with HIV RNA below 50 copies at 24 weeks. At week 24, 90% of patients achieved 90% of patients achieved HIV RNA below 50 copies per ml. It's interesting to point out that at week 8, about 60% of patients had HIV viral load below 50 copies. At week 24, change in HIV RNA from baseline was minus 2.4. Again, it's interesting, as it has been shown in other studies with ratlegavir, to point out the rapid decrease in HIV RNA in these patients. Overall, only 10 patients had HIV RNAs higher than 50 copies in this study. One patient was lost to follow-up, one discontinued IRV because of a serious adverse event. 3 patients had viral loads higher to 400 copies at week 24. Adherence issues were reported by investigators in these patients. 2 patients had viral loads between 50 and 400. And finally, in 3 patients, viral loads were higher than 50 at week 24, but this was not confirmed at week 32. So overall, 5 out of 10 patients with failures had low viral loads. At week 24, median CD4 change from baseline was at 99 cells. 2 grade 4 clinical adverse events and 5 grade 4 laboratory adverse events possibly related to investigational drugs were reported. Among clinical adverse events, one patient presented a rash with fever that led to treatment discontinuation. One patient presented nephrolithiasis that did not lead to treatment discontinuation. Among laboratory-related adverse events, 4 had creatine kinase elevation. All were asymptomatic. All had values that returned to normal without treatment discontinuation. One patient had GGT elevation. This was HCV co-infected patients with intermittent GGT fluctuation. No treatment discontinuation was required in these patients. This slide shows results of the clinical trials conducted in the last years in treatment-experienced patients with MDR virus. As you can see in clinical trials over time, the efficacy of ART in this population has dramatically increased thanks to the use of more fully active drugs when designing a new regimen. In the TRIO trial, from what we learned, which is not a randomized control trial, but a clinical trial, from what we learned in these randomized control trials, we were able to add three fully drugs in all patients with highly resistant virus. Thus, we were able to demonstrate viral load suppression rates similar to those reported in antiretroviral naive patients. In summary, TRIO results at 24 weeks show that in patients with resistant viruses and historically few remaining treatment options, raltegravir, etravirine, and darunavir resulted in a high rate of virological suppression. In addition, this regimen was generally well tolerated. Ongoing analysis in the TRIO study include durability of biologic efficacy and tolerability up to 96 weeks, genotypic analysis of resistance among failing patients and drug-drug interactions. I missed my acknowledgement results, which if you give me 1 minute, I don't know why it's missed. Anyway, I want to finish to acknowledge patients for their participation and their commitment during this study, to acknowledge TRIO Scientific and DSMB, to acknowledge Merck and Tibotec for providing raltegravir with etravirine. Thanks. To acknowledge clinical centers, and finally to acknowledge VINRS. Thank you for your attention.
Question microphone number one over there.
Is this one?
Yeah.
Andrew Zalopa, Palo Alto. Very nice presentation. I just wanted to know if the optimized background regimen had any influence on the overall result. Did you look at that by the GSS?
So I didn't present that because when you have 90% efficacy, it's kind of difficult to do stratification analysis. But we looked at that, and both sides was 88 versus 92. So it was the same thing. But I think it doesn't mean anything when you have 90% efficacy.
I understand that, but the trend was in favor of having some...
The trend was the opposite, actually.
Ah, well, that's important to know. So it was less than the folks who had...
less than the folks who had, yeah, optimized background therapy with nukes. And for T20, we also looked at that for infigratide, and it was equal, 90% versus 90%. But again, that was only 10 patients naive to infigratide.
Thank you.
No further questions? With that, we end our session on late breakers. Thank you very much to the presenters and for you for being here.